A king ruled the state in the early days. The harder he tried, the less he got done. The prince ordered his head chopped off. They took the axe and the saw to the forest. The petals fall with the next puff of wind. What joy there is in living.
Hello all, Nina here, in for Patrick Cox, and this is The World in Words. And that was Harvard Sentence Found poem by Max Bartlett from Moscow, Idaho. Thanks, Max. And thanks so many of you. Super submissions from many people. For those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, I did a story, I guess it was last week, about Harvard sentences. They're sentences developed in a secret basement laboratory at Harvard during World War II to test how we hear. And they're still used today in everything from testing cochlear implants to staticky cell phones. The sentences range from fairly mundane to oddly profound. We made this poetry widget to help people create found poems, sort of like those, you know, poetry refrigerator magnets. And so I promised that I would read some of them on the podcast. Thanks, Max. And this one is from Katie Greer. The glow deepened in the eyes of the sweet girl. The boy was there when the sun rose. He lay prone and hardly moved a limb. We frown when events take a bad turn. They could laugh, although they were sad. We are sure that one war is enough. A fresh start will work such wonders. See what I'm saying? Fairly mundane and oddly profound. One final note about the Harvard sentence story. Well, sort of. In the course of reporting things, you get to speak with pretty interesting people. And there's so much stuff that gets cut out and you gotta leave on the cutting room floor. Kill all your darlings. But this is a podcast where darlings live, sort of. And I just wanted to share a few of them. I spoke for the story for a long time to a professor named David Pizzoni. He directs the Speech Research Laboratory at the University of Indiana. And he knows a lot about the Harvard Lab, where all the hearing research was taking place during World War II. He studied at MIT and lived in Cambridge for a while. He's an interesting dude.
My field is human speech perception, but I've done a lot of different things. You know, I could go on and, you know, I was involved in the Exxon Valdez case, which you probably don't know about. Not too many people know about it. It was a long time ago. Some people, students today, they don't even know what the Exxon Valdez is.
It was a big giant oil spill.
Yes.
I remember.
Yes, it was in Prince William Sound. And they had an audio, the Coast Guard had an audio tape of Captain Hazelwood talking to the Coast Guard. And I was asked by the NTSB, the National Transportation Safety Board, in 1989, they called me and asked me whether I could determine whether Captain Hazelwood was drunk at the time of the accident by doing acoustic analysis of his speech.
And?
Well, you know, this is, the bottom line is, let's put it this way. What we wrote in our report was that his speech changed in a way that was consistent with what we know about the effects of alcohol on speech.
In other words, he was drunk. You see, I told you, he's just interesting. Well, today, Professor Pizzoni does research on cochlear implants in infants and children. But it was the story of how he actually got interested in speech and audiology that got me. I'm a sucker for origin stories. As an undergraduate, one of his professors played an audio recording for him.
You know, we didn't have iPods in 1964 and 1965.
We had
audio tapes. He played an audio tape of a talking computer in 1965, one that he had worked on, a synthesis system, when he was at Bell Labs in the 1960s, which was, you know, like ancient. I mean, it's like almost medieval times. When you think about it, you know, when you listen to this audio tape of this computer talking.
Do you still have it? Do you still have it?
Yes, I do. Absolutely.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Those words were spoken by an electronic digital computer, which was programmed to simulate a speaking machine.
To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether it is nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles, and by opposing end them, to die, to sleep.
To sleep, perchance to dream. Ah, there's the rub. For for in this sleep of death what dreams may come. This is 1965, Pizzoni kept explaining. 1965! And this little tiny bit of Shakespeare inspired him to dedicate his life to speech. Or maybe actually it was this haunting ditty that comes after the Shakespeare.
Daisy, Daisy, give me your answer to. I'm half crazy, all for the love of you. It won't be a stylish marriage. I can't afford a carriage. But you look sweet upon the seat of a bicycle built for two.
Thanks for listening.
Yep, thanks for listening to my little darlings. Okay, on to the meat of the podcast. Today, I have two short language hits for you. First, the historical present. Sportscasters use it. You do it when you're telling a joke. Historians use it. Making the past present. But I'll let Patrick Cox explain.
Here's a joke. Vincent van Gogh walks into a bar. Wait a minute. Vincent van Gogh's dead. Shouldn't it be walked into a bar? Ah, it's just a joke, right? We do it all the time with jokes. But increasingly, we do it with other stuff, too. Historians do it. The first time I noticed hearing it in person was about a dozen years ago when I interviewed Marion Smith. She's the in-house historian with the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. I was asking her about the U.S. Border Patrol and its use of horses. Here's what she told me.
Horses were the traditional tool used by the Border Patrol along the border. Certainly, they were more widely used earlier in the 20th century, not only because the Border Patrolmen are working in remote areas and all, but because there is not...
Did you hear that? She started off in the past tense.
Horses were the traditional tool.
She stuck with the past tense for just one more sentence, then boom, we're in the present tense.
Not only because the Border Patrolmen are working in remote areas and all, but because there is not...
Smith continued.
As time goes on...
Time goes on? In what? Some kind of suspended, ever-present state?
As time goes on and the Border Patrol adopts different technology, they've wanted to move from horses to, like, to jeeps after World War II. But they still found at times that technology didn't always do it. They had to have the horses.
Now, this was the point at which I got really confused. We were back in the past tense, where we'd started. As I later discovered, this is a popular way for historians to relate past events. Use a frame of the past tense at the beginning and end of the story, but in the middle, switch to the present, or as it's often referred to, the historical present. Now, as someone who talks on the radio and in podcasts, I must confess to using the present tense a lot to describe the past. But not the distant past, the World War II past. That, to my ears, is jarring. Not everyone thinks so. Here's Kate Williams, a historian at Royal Holloway, University of London.
I feel that as historians, we're always trying to encourage people to enjoy the past and think carefully about the past. And I think the present tense is a very important tool we can use it for, because if we don't think about what happened in the past, if we don't think about how it could impact on us now, we will make the same mistakes.
It's a technique borrowed from... well, jokes, as well as old newsreel films and poetry and fiction. Fair enough. But this is history. And I know it isn't merely a sequence of events, but don't historians have a responsibility to tell history and acknowledge a certain pastness of past events? Writer and translator Miranda France would like them to do a bit more of that.
They start talking in the present and then they can't sort of reflect all those differences in time. And so they then switch and go back into the past. So you're constantly readjusting to try to understand where you are. It's like looking at a painting where no perspective has been used and everything is on the same plane.
Now, French and Spanish, and maybe some other languages too, do use the historical present more than us, and more formally in writing as well as speech. And it's possible that English may follow suit if historians continue to tell us that Paul Revere rides to Lexington, or Hillary Clinton becomes America's first female president. Wait, there's something wrong there. But if history increasingly has the appearance of being in the present, will it affect how we think about it?
I really don't think it's going to change our perception of the past.
This is Ben Yagoda, a language blogger and author, most recently of The B-Side, The Death of Tin Pan Alley and the Rebirth of the Great American Song. He first complained about the historical present in a New York Times essay in 1986.
I was a little harsher then.
He wrote that too many people, fiction writers he was talking about then, too many people were using the technique without understanding the underpinnings. Yagoda says, for historians, it comes from the same urge to grasp unthinkingly for the immediacy of the present tense.
In their speech and their presentation, it shows that historians, like the rest of us, are prone to cliche and vogue modes of presentation. They're not immune. But I don't think that it has a deeper meaning in relation to our understanding of history.
So maybe we're safe. We still understand the past to be the past, even when it's in the present. Vincent van Gogh is still dead. Oh yeah, the joke. I never told the punchline. Okay, Vincent van Gogh walks into a bar. Barman says, "You want a drink?" Vince replies, "Nah, I've got one here."
Thank you, Patrick. He left me with another gem of a joke for y'all. Okay, past, present, and future walk into a bar. It was tense. All right, finally. A bit of a turnabout.
Brethren, 'tis no longer befitting for the likes of us to pass judgment on him. He'll be coming face to face with old Flint himself, he will, and be made to give proper accounting for his evil ways. Amen.
That's actor Robert Newton playing Long John Silver in one of his pirate flicks of the 1950s. Of course, pirates and sailors didn't really talk like that, as the world's history guy Chris Wolfe explains to the world's host, Marco Werman.
Newton is known now as the patron saint of International Talk Like a Pirate Day, and it's very unlikely that many sailors spoke like that. He was just asked by his director to try and sound a little bit more exotic for the first Treasure Island movie in 1950 and decided to go back to his roots, and that's an English West Country accent. A lot of people talk like that in Devon and Cornwall and Dorsetshire now.
So what was or is the actual language of the high seas then?
Well, of course, there was never one single language spoken on the high seas, but English, an English-based language, did come to dominate from around 1700 through about 1975. You know, and you got to think that in every culture, there's a need for a kind of a multinational, multiracial crew to understand each other and what they're saying. There's a lot of technical terms to throw in there as well. And so there's words from the ancient languages, like captain comes from Latin, because people have been sailing since the dawn of time. Then there's words that come in from the big trading nations of the late Middle Ages, like skipper comes from Dutch, admiral from Italian. And then English comes to dominate, but all kinds of other foreign terms come in, like shanty is allegedly French, deco is a Hindi word for having a look around, shufti is an Arabic word for the same thing. And then Native American languages like hammock and hurricane, those are Carib words. So even in the as early as the 18th century, you see writers talking about how incomprehensible sailors were because they had their own language. So it was totally misunderstood by landlubbers.
So Chris, give us a few examples of some words that have come off the high seas and which we now use in regular everyday speech.
There are almost too many to count, Marco. You could find any port in a storm. You could do something that's above board. You could press gang someone into working for you. You could be green, meaning a novice. In England, the nursery of the Royal Navy, as they used to call it, was the Newfoundland cod trade, going off to fish for cod off of Newfoundland. Every ship was required by law to bring 10% of its crew as new hands, people who had never been to sea before. And they were always seasick, so they're always considered green.
Mm. And you were saying earlier, even the cat's out of the bag?
Absolutely. This is more of a Royal Navy kind of thing. The cat of nine tails was the whip with nine strands that was used for punishment. And so when you saw the cat coming out of the bag, you knew someone was in trouble. Also, though, you couldn't swing a cat of nine tails below deck because there's no room to swing a cat. And you'd be over a barrel waiting for your punishment because that's where you'd be tied up.
Wow. We could go on all day, it sounds like. It's not just language, is it? It's culture.
Well, yes, the seamen were distinguished, you know, up to the modern period by their dress, by their walk, trying to adjust for the pitch and roll of the ship. And they danced differently, obviously. They stood in one place instead of moving around. And customs, like, you know why good children are taught not to put their elbows on the table.
Wow, this goes back to the ships, too.
Exactly, because when you're on a sailing ship, you need to put your elbows on the table to hold your bowl to keep your food steady from sliding across the table, so you could just like dip your bread in and eat like that. So when a press gang broke into a pub looking for people to push into the Navy, they'd be looking for anybody sitting with their elbows on the table. So good boys wouldn't do that, so they don't get press ganged.
I love talking to you. So today, the crew's on these big ships taking containers all over the world. It's an international scene, very international crew. What's happened to the language?
Well, English is still kind of the official language of navigation on the seas as it is in the airwaves. We've all heard, you know, international pilots speaking English or trying to. Below decks, though, is probably a different story. Most of the crews come from the Philippines, so they're probably speaking Tagalog or other Philippine languages. But the culture has all changed because you only need a handful of men to run one of these giant container ships, whereas you may have used to have had 50 or more people on board a ship. And at the same time, they're coming in and out of dock to unload. They can unload one of those giant container ships in 24 hours and get back to sea, which is exactly what, you know, a good shipping company would want to do to maximize their profit and void idle time. So, you know, used to be join the Navy, go see the world kind of thing, and just spend time in foreign ports. It doesn't really happen that way.
The world's Chris Wolf. I guess my one addition here is anchors away. Thank you.
Stay on an even keel, Marco.
I pulled the world's history guy into the studio with me for just a few more minutes because he has been coming up to my desk all day with new, fun words from the sea. Okay, Chris, hit me. Okay, what are some of your favorites that you've just been?
Scuttlebutt.
Scuttlebutt, what is that?
A scuttles was a thing that you had in a ship, like a Navy ship, and if you wanted to sink it quickly to stop it getting captured, you would pull the scuttles out and the ship would sink because water's going to flood in. So a scuttle came to mean anything with holes in. So a water butt with the drinking water for the ship's crew in was called the scuttlebutt. So it's like the original water cooler where guys would go and gossip.
Oh.
And then there's cultural things like getting spliced or hitched. You know, splicing a rope is when you splice two broken ropes together through by using the individual threads, splicing them together, or hitched.
Like married. So spliced would be getting married getting, as well.
Yep. And the payoff. At the end of a voyage, the crew is paid off, literally. And so that's the big payoff you're waiting for at the end of the trip. And of course, if you encounter a storm, you're going to batten down the hatches. And you wouldn't want to be overwhelmed, which is a Middle English term for capsized.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
One of my favorites when I talked to the sea captain, he told me that he had swallowed the anchor at a certain point. And he had meant that he had now was working on land.
Right. He wasn't beached anymore waiting for a voyage. He had finally decided to take the big payoff and stay ashore. yes. Probably a first-rate decision. Well, first-rate, there's another thing. That's the old system of rating naval warships. So a first-rate was the biggest you could get. Second-rate was next one down, depending on how many cannons you had. Mm. So your third-rate ones are really not really worth worrying about too much. You'd give them a wide berth, so you wouldn't want to have another collision. And then you might want to show your true colors if you're trying to capture another ship. You might wait until the last minute before you show your true colors.
So showing
literally,
a
flag. You're flying a false flag, and then you would hold it down and pull up your own when you wanted to surprise them. You could be taken aback by that, which is the same as when the wind suddenly rushes into your sails. Or you could reverse, have the wind taken out of your sails, which is a bad thing, of course. And then if you're scootling along and suddenly you're in shallow water and you're scraping bottom, things are touch and go. But, you know, we need to get underway right now with another question.
What's your favorite, actually, after all of this research into high seas lingo? Oh,
it's just, I can't fathom it. You're plumbing the depths here. I got the lay of the land, but I'm starting to learn the ropes. I'll never know the ropes. We'll just jury-rig some answer, and am I leaving me high and dry here?
Okay, thanks so much, Chris.
You're welcome.
Yeah, he didn't stop all day. And coming full circle to those moments that don't make the cut, off mic, Chris sang me a silly version of the British naval song, Sailor's Hornpipe. So I forced him and our managing editor, and another Brit, Jonathan Dyer, back into the studio for an encore.
He's a naval man, you can tell it by his walk. He's a naval man, you can tell it by his talk. For the drunken things he'll utter as he's lying in the gutter. You can bet your bread and butter, he's a naval man.
Thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm on Twitter, @Porzuki. Bon voyage.
With a girl in every port, if he hums a little ditty and he tells you that you're pretty, you can bet your Bristol cities he's a naval man. If his kit bag's full of wrinkles, he's a naval man. If he stinks of rum and winkles, he's a naval man. If he tries to kiss and hug you, shouting once aboard the lugger, he's a dirty, rotten person, he's a naval man. If he tries to take you sailing on the Serpentine, if he tries to slip his hand beneath your plimsoll line, if he grabs you without warning, you can bet the skin you're born in, you'll be scuppered in the morning, he's a naval man.
The World in Words is made possible in part by a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, Exploring the Human Endeavor.
Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.